Before we begin, I'd like to provide a content warning. This is a powerful episode and one where we dig into some really tough topics around how the maternity care system is failing families. We look at topics around obstetrical violence, strong language is used. This might not be the right episode for you if you are currently pregnant, so just proceed with caution. But if you're ready, this is an episode you won't soon forget if you are interested in birth advocacy and fighting to improve birth. Hi, friends, and welcome to the Plus Mommy Podcast. I'm your host, Jen McClellan, and here we explore plus-size pregnancy, motherhood, and body love. From bumps to bellies, we talk about it all. Now, let's get started. Hi, friends. Today, we are joined by Dawn Thompson. Dawn is the founder of Improving Birth, Birthify, a doula, and a just incredible advocate, and has done amazing work for over a decade now to change and transform maternal health. She is someone I deeply admire and have been honored to know for almost a decade. Welcome to the show, Dawn!
Thanks so much. That was such a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so excited. I've been wanting to get you on the show for so long. I first connected with you in person in 2013 at the second annual Birth Activist Retreat. I don't even think that's still happening anymore. But I first learned about you and your work in 2012 with Improving Birth when I went to my first rally. And I was like, who is this amazing person and all the work that they've done and all you've done for so long? And you were just featured in the documentary Born Free, which I watched, and it's so compelling. And I could keep you on for like 14 hours and we could talk about it all. But I promise listeners, I won't do that. We'll keep it to about an hour. But Dawn, why don't you start by telling us just a little bit about you and your work? And then I want to hear how you got into this work.
Oh, that's a lot.
I know, that's a big question.
Well, I mean, of course, all of us usually end up here because of our own birth experiences, right?
Yeah.
Right. We always have to have, we've all got our why, our story. And mine definitely was related to the fact that I, you know, had a cesarean with my first baby that was unexpected. I did all the things, right, that typical people do. I took a childbirth education class. I read What to Expect When You're Expecting. I thought that my obstetrician would just tell me what to do and I would go to the hospital and do it. I really did not understand the system, and I mean, nor should I have had to, you know?
Right.
You know, my first birth didn't end the way I had anticipated it to. And subsequently my second birth, I attempted a VBAC and that was not successful. And
that's a vaginal birth after cesarean for anyone who's like, what's a VBAC?
Yeah. And then I was looking for a life purpose. I was working in marketing and public relations. I worked in a cubicle for a big company and I pretty much hated it. And I had just married my wonderful husband and he had two kids and I had two kids and he had majority custody of his kids too. So we had, you know, we were raising four kids suddenly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it gave me some stability. I'd been a single mom for quite a few years, and it gave me some stability to kind of look deeply into myself and see what I wanted to do. And it's a very long story, but I became a doula, and through a lot of crazy circumstances and a lot of manifesting in prayer, you know, like just, I just needed guidance and here's where I ended up. And so it felt very kismet.
What year was that that you became a doula and this journey kind of began?
2002.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
20 years.
Oh my gosh. 20 years.
20 years. Wow. So I hit the ground running. I was tremendously successful in my community. I joined the birth network here and I grew that to about 80 members. I actually came on as vice president and I was vice president, I think, for 7 years, 8 years,
wow.
You know, really trying to build it to a business because I'd had a business background, right? And not all doulas come into this work with a business background. So yeah, so I used those skills and I became a doula, which then, you know, made me start to see my births in a very different light.
Right.
With new information that I was like, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. I was just a statistic. I did not need that induction. I did not need that cesarean. I could have been way more prepared for a VBAC and I wasn't. I just didn't know what I didn't know.
Right.
And that's unfortunately what pretty much every woman in America faces when they're going down the road of having a baby. Mm-hmm. And pretty quickly, I was appalled at what I was seeing in the hospital. It was so very different from what I was learning through research, through studies. I don't want to just say it was just my doula training because it wasn't, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people be like, oh, you're just a doula. It's like, well, okay, I started out that way, but I strive for education, right? And information. And so I was reading ACOG's standards. I was reading the American Academy of Pediatrics standards and the midwifery standards. And it was very clear that I had a very different experience and training on normal physiological birth than what was being administered in a hospital system. And I got pretty frustrated pretty quickly. You know, I always think that crazy things happen for a reason, and it's been my path. Like, I can look clearly back at the trajectory of my where I am now. And we found out that a local hospital here, as a nurse, leaked a report that showed that the local hospital here had an 80% C-section rate on Thursdays and Fridays in my community of San Diego.
Stop it.
Yeah. So, which is clearly physician scheduling.
Yes.
Right. And scheduling it. So, you know, I mean, one could assume that it was to avoid coming in on the weekends.
Yeah.
And I would like to say that over the years, my empathy for physicians has grown. It has. I know there's some real jerks out there. There's no question. I've met many. But I also don't believe that doctors and nurses go to the hospital or go to the job every day thinking, who can they traumatize today? I don't
right.
believe. I think that it's a grooming of the system mm-hmm. that grooms their behavior. Yeah. And it's a broken system that we're all navigating. Clients, parents and physicians and nurses and administrators and all of that. So it's a problem with the whole system. I didn't used to believe that. You know, I used to be pretty brimstone and fire and ready to light everyone on fire, but I've grown and I think matured in my thinking. And so,
yeah, I tell parents that doulas are like the gatekeepers of their community, right? Like, they know what hospital they would go to give birth at and what physicians or midwives they'd want to work with and chiropractors and so on. And we all have these conversations that are out of frustration, right? You almost wish we could like record some of these conversations we have behind doors and leak it so parents knew like what we see and how much harm is being done that isn't even evidence-based as you were right. seeing. There is a gap here. But so, you know, tens of thousands of us have these conversations, but not many of us go to that next place. So you wanted to do more and start advocacy and a grassroots organization. So tell us what brought you to launching Improving Birth.
Well, I think, you know, the first thing is I kept saying for probably a good couple of years, why isn't anyone talking about this?
Yeah.
Because in 2002, there was little to nothing in the media about any of this, about
right.
overuse of interventions, about C-section, nothing. And I just kept saying, why aren't people talking about this? You know, I really believe that pregnant folks would make a lot of different decisions if they had all of the information.
Yeah.
So the hospital leaked this report and I kept saying, why isn't someone doing something? And then I realized maybe I could be someone. Right? Like, maybe that needs to be me.
You are that someone with a background in PR and marketing too. Right. Yes.
Yes. So I decided to create a video slideshow about the hospital and their statistics and that we were going to hold a protest in front of their hospital.
Wow.
And yeah. And so I had gotten referred to a local paper here, our weekly paper, and the reporter had been referred to me to just ask questions and stuff about, and I shared my experience. And what had happened was the editor of the paper had just had his baby at that hospital. And what the doctor didn't know when he walked in and said, oh, you're lucky that your wife didn't have a C-section. And the dad said, why does she need a C-section? Like, why is it? Should I be nervous or something? He said, oh, no. It's just because it's after 5 o'clock and your doctor would have done a cesarean by now.
Oh, my goodness.
So the doctor just said this flippantly, not knowing who he's talking to.
A reporter. Yeah. Yes. So and a new parent.
The editor of, one of our largest newspapers in town. And so when he came back from paternity leave, he pulled this reporter and said, I want you to do a story on this hospital cesarean rate.
Wow.
And so she did a 3-month or 4-month deep dive and interviewed probably 4 or 5 different people. She tried to interview the hospital, but they declined her request, not knowing that she was about to do a major story. It wound up being the cover story to the local paper that week that weekly paper. It wound up being the cover story and it wound up selling out. And the cover said, the unkindest cut. It was, I actually have a copy of it.
Wow. Yes. That would be amazing to see. Wow.
How cool is that?
Oh my goodness.
And it was basically the hospital that claims to be mother and baby friendly. And yeah. And so I knew that event was coming. I mean, I knew this paper was coming out. It wound up being a 5-page spread in the paper.
Whoa.
Anyways, and so we decided to hold the rally in front of their hospital just 3 days after the article was released because we knew it was coming.
And what year was this?
That was in, what year is it? 2012? Nope, 2011.
2011.
Yeah, 2012 was our first national rally. But yeah, so 2011, fast forward, we did a rally. We had a news blitz. We got every news station and paper in town to do a story. And the hospital started freaking out. And they asked to meet with me. God, what I wouldn't give to have that meeting now.
Right.
That I know so much more. And I've I felt intimidated and scared and all those things in that moment.
But I said, you still showed up.
Totally. And I said some great things. But, oh man, I'd love to do that again today. I think we would have a very different discussion, but.
Well, maybe today they would take your call without you having to do a rally in front of their hospital.
Maybe.
I would think so.
Yeah. Well, during that planning, my girlfriend who was helping me plan it said, wouldn't this be amazing if we do it all across the country on the same day?
Yes.
So that's what I did. 9 months later, we had the first rally to improve birth. On Labor Day.
Yes.
Again, I knew my marketing brain was, we need a catch, right? And so we used Labor Day as a catch. And we had it all across the country. We had it in 110 cities and 46 states.
I was at the Denver one. I'll put photos in the show notes at plusmommy.com because I think I was about to become certified as a childbirth educator. But at that point, I had started my blog and I was just learning about the birth world. And I was like, what is this improving birth? This is amazing. We need this. And I remember, and there were news reporters in our Denver one, like it was such an invigorating experience to be like, yeah, like other people are having this conversation. This is a conversation we need to be happening. And it was around the same time that The Business of Being Born had come out and the conversation was slowly starting to shift in not just behind the walls of birth advocates' doors and birth circle meetings and local areas, but with parents. It was starting to become slightly a little more mainstream, and you helped catapult that conversation.
Thank you. You know, I mean, the next few years, I mean, Improving Birth had a really probably strong 7-year run.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it quickly started becoming unsustainable. We just weren't making enough money to survive. I was, you know, I had gone without an income that whole time. Thank God my husband was, you know, able to sustain us. I shouldn't say without an income. I was still doing doula work and postpartum work.
But while spending countless hours running this massive national nonprofit with countless volunteers, I mean, that takes more time than you can even imagine. Yeah, we had
a pretty decent team, but none of us were getting paid. We were all volunteers. Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't know that. I think there's a lot of people who think we were, you know, rolling in it or something, but none of us were taking a pay. We were literally just making enough to keep it going.
But that says actually a lot, because everything was so professional, so well executed, so well done. Like it, I just, and your website and the advocacy information that you were getting out into the world, like, yeah, I could assume people are like, oh, they're, you know, financially hugely successful. Yeah. It's like, this is maternal, you know, mortality work that we're doing in maternity care. And people at that time weren't funding that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. You know, and Kristen Piscucci was just a huge part of our growth, and Rebecca Decker from Evidence-Based Birth. Yes. Right?
I love them both, and I've had them both on the show. Yeah.
They were both my team, right? That was when Evidence-Based Birth was just getting started.
Yeah.
But it just became unsustainable. Kristen couldn't keep doing it. And I understood, she was a single mom.
Yeah.
And sold her car, y'all. She sold her car to keep, so that she could pay her rent, so that we could keep doing this work. Because we just kept hoping something big was going to happen finally, right? We were going to get the funding. We were going to get the grants. We were going to, it was just like, and it was this never ending challenge that just became unsustainable. And like, we have a lot of the resources still out there. Our Facebook page is still out there, but it's not really functioning any longer as an organization, even though we grew it to this big thing.
I know.
Kristen moving on was a big loss for us. She was just an incredible writer, and she's really what drove our following. And, you know, I was the inspiration behind it, but she was definitely the gas, you know?
Yeah.
So her leaving was challenging, and we never really recovered. Honestly, yeah. But that's like a whole nother story. So,
but you know, that happens, right? And a lot in birth work without huge momentum all the time, it fizzles out. And a lot of people want to shift the conversation. And yes, I think as parents, we're very much in this conversation during pregnancy and then postpartum, but then life happens and we have kids and school, and like the conversation doesn't stay up top of mind unless you end up becoming a birth professional like you and I did after going through our pregnancy and birth experiences.
That's right. Well, I'll tell you that, you know, I mean, where I am now is, you know, one of the things about improving birth was it kind of went in a direction that I didn't plan on.
And which one was that?
Well, I mean, I just had a vision of getting more information into the hands of pregnant folks.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, or I mean, not unfortunately, I shouldn't say that. I mean, it took the road it needed to, but it turned really into a trauma organization because what was happening was the women who had already been and the families that had already been traumatized by the system were looking for help, and we were the only thing. And so we really became a tool for families who'd already been hurt by the system.
Yeah. I remember that shift towards more obstetrical violence conversations and how to report. And but it was so necessary, and I dare I say even radical at the time for those resources to be developed, when you're like, this is a no-brainer. If you were going into surgery and they cut off your left leg instead of your right, and said, well, too bad, I'm not even going to ask you consent. Like, that would be a huge lawsuit. But somehow in birth, when things happen without consent and things happen that should never happen, no one seems to care.
For sure.
At the time, especially.
Unfortunately. Yeah. And so Kristen has continued the obstetric violence stuff with her own business.
Yeah. Birth Monopoly. And I'll put her episode in the show notes too.
Yeah, great. And it's such a critical discussion, but it's not what my heart was. And I, you know, I shared with you before we started recording that my initial mission statement when I started improving birth was to reduce the unnecessary cesarean and induction rate.
Yeah.
And I really needed to get back to that because that's my core, right?
Yeah.
I firmly believe that pregnant families need way more information than they're getting.
Yeah.
And the system is overwhelming. The Google is overwhelming. Mm-hmm. The chat groups that people go to seek advice is frightening.
Yeah.
You know, the old wives' tales that their mothers are telling them that's super outdated is frightening. Mm-hmm. You know, people just walk into birth with absolutely no idea. And far too many come out of it saying, if I would have known this, I wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, I hear that every day.
Every day. And there's lots of folks who are just like, well, I mean, at least I have a healthy baby.
Yeah.
That's all that really matters. That's all that matters. But their own experience is often they just discount it and ignore it and push it off. And for some people, that's fine and they can manage it. But a lot of other people can't, right?
No.
And so I've turned to Create Birthify.
Ooh, tell us everything. I'm so excited.
Yes. It was born out of COVID, like so many other things. And I know there's other businesses that are, you know, trying to scale in this area too, but it's virtual support. I had actually already started building my own virtual coaching, before COVID ever happened, because I wanted to go live abroad. We wanted to go live abroad. And, so the decision was how do I still make money? And I'm like, well, I've got a lot of information and I'm happy to share it. Right. So I know that people get value because I get calls all the time of like, hey, my sister's pregnant. Could you talk to her? Hey, I probably get 3 or 4 texts a week from people in my life that know somebody who's pregnant who like, oh, their doctor's trying to push them into induction. Would you talk to them? Oh, that, you know, like it happens all day long. So I knew that I could like, that I probably should monetize that instead of just giving away my time all the time.
Yeah.
Right. So when COVID hit and everybody started panicking, doulas, families, everybody's like, holy cow, how do we manage this? We can suddenly no longer support our clients in the hospitals. And I was like, oh, I got this. I can help you. And so I threw up a website and I started teaching virtual doula training. How do you help your client? And then we started getting clients who were like, I still want to have a doula, but what do I do? And so we started getting clients that way. And I was like, okay, so this is something people want.
Yeah.
And so Birthify was born. It has been 2 years now and we've gone through several versions of what will work. And in the end, we've really taken on what like the mental health space has done, right? BetterHelp, Talkspace, those online therapy. It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
So we are literally taking their model of, you know, 30-minute video chats per week and unlimited texting and messaging with a birth professional.
Wow. Yeah. To have someone in your back pocket throughout pregnancy, like that's amazing.
For everything. And it's not just pregnancy. It's all the way through the first 3 months of after birth.
So necessary. You almost need more help then. I mean, I'm not going to say more, like, but postpartum doulas are like, we don't talk about that as much. And it's so critically important.
So true. So, you know, that idea is that you just have somebody who can answer all these little questions that come up, diaper rash, infant sleep. Should I get induced? What are the risks and benefits of this? And, you know, and that's been our job. And, you know, the most important thing is that we're not here to make medical decisions, right? Or give medical advice. We're here to give you information so that you can make the best decision for you. And we will support you in whatever that decision is. We just currently had a client who decided she wanted to do a planned cesarean because she had some mental health issues that she was really concerned about for labor, to go into labor. She was afraid of it. And so we were like, okay, these are the risks. These are the benefits. This is how we can have the best birth possible in your scenario. And a lot of people want to think, because I talk a lot about anti-induction, because I am a little bit anti, but it doesn't mean that I have a bias about it, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that I'm not going to support you in whatever decision.
Absolutely. I meet people where they're at and provide them with the support they need. That's and right. Evidence-based information. And then ultimately, I respect that people have autonomy over their body and can make whatever choice they want. Imagine that. Like, it's not that difficult. But in the meantime, you and I both share information to help improve health outcomes for people during pregnancy and their children. Like, you can do it all and still meet people where they're at. I don't think it's that complicated. It's just a completely broken system.
100%. Well, and you know, I mean, how much can your physician share with you in their 6-minute visit?
Right. I mean, we used to say 15 and now we say like 5 minutes. Like I can't. So to have that 12, supplement.
But yeah, still 12 minutes is not enough time. Once a month, by the way, and maybe twice a month, right? It's just not enough time.
No.
To help, you know, and tell you all the things that you need to know. And so they typically, all they share is the information that relates to what they think and want you to do.
Yeah.
And that is lacking severely in so many different ways.
Yes.
You know, I remember when I was getting induced, nobody told me anything. Nobody told me that there was risks to induction, that this might put my baby in distress. And it might, you know, cause me to have an emergency cesarean because my baby was in distress now because the Pitocin was so high that it was, you know, like, I mean, I could go on, right? The snowball effect, but nobody told me that beforehand. I didn't. Yeah. I just thought he was just like, well, do you want to have your baby today? And I was like, yeah, I want to have my baby today. I've been waiting 9 months for this nonsense. You know, like I'm so excited. Not knowing that it would be, you know, 2 or 3 days later and I would be horrifically exhausted and now recovering from major surgery.
But look at what happened and then now the millions of lives that you've impacted. And not that I wish that that had ever happened to you, my goodness, but you took that experience and you became an amazing advocate. And I look at your journey from literally like rallying on the ground. Like I was marching with, you know, not with you because you were in another state, you were in California, right. But like, you know, having all these people on the ground to now you're able to support a limitless amount of people virtually and to create that change. Like that's absolutely amazing, Dawn. You're incredible. I'm curious, what are some of the biggest changes that you have seen over the past just over a decade now that you've really been entrenched in advocacy? And I know you've done a lot of work with Mom Congress and so many other incredible organizations and legislative work. And what are some of those big picture changes that you've seen inching? Because I'm not going to say what has been fixed because nothing's been fixed. But like,
well, and in some cases, we've recently gone backwards. But that's right. We'll get into that, I'm sure. Yeah. But I think that we saw that business of being born, the rallies, like we saw a lot of families making different choices about induction and interventions for a handful of years there that was really feeling exciting.
Yeah.
But the maternal mortality crisis is a hot topic. I think that is so important.
And that we're talking about Black maternal mortality rates now on such a big platforms and it's becoming a conversation that everyone is talking about is so incredibly necessary. And that wasn't happening a decade for ago at all.
There might be people that aren't happy for me to say this, but I'll just tell you. The thing that's hard for me about that is that is it horrific? Is it terrible? Should we be doing better? 100%. Are Black women struggling way more than anybody else? Absolutely. But overuse of interventions is a much, much bigger problem than the maternal mortality issue that we have in this nation. It's a problem. And I'll just use some numbers. Over 700,000 cesareans a year are considered unnecessary. Over 70% of laborers, and probably even more now, are either induced or sped up with drugs. Over 50,000 women are near misses, meaning like they nearly die every year. And a good number of those is because of the overuse of interventions.
Yeah. And but so if we tackle if we tackle that, then it impacts our maternity mortality rates. Yeah.
The question is, I mean, but if we start having that conversation about maternal mortality, then it's going to go up to those things. And I get that. And that's what I'm hopeful for. But unfortunately, some of the things that I see is that they're just trying to put, you know, they're like, oh, so one of the reasons for maternal mortality is hemorrhage, right? Hemorrhaging after. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is to create a hemorrhage cart and put that out of in front of every laboring room, which I think is amazing, except for the fact that we failed to discuss why is the woman hemorrhaging?
Right.
Yeah. The cart is a band-aid to the bigger issue, and that is we're intervening too often. We're inducing women way too frequently, and Pitocin is known to cause hemorrhage.
And now we're touting one story that showed, better outcomes if we did just induce as routine. And the ARRIVE trial. It's just
literally the bane of my existence right now.
Yeah. But that's what we're hearing. Oh, but it's safe. And we have these studies and.
There's OBs all over TikTok praising it.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is the part that I was saying about going backwards. So just to give the viewers a little background, the ARRIVE trial was released 5 or 6 years ago. I was actually at the ACOG meeting when they did it on the main stage. And I was having a meeting with their executive staff when it happened. So, and what's interesting is at the beginning of that meeting, they asked everyone, because they have in ACOG at their main stage, they have a one of those devices where you can do a poll and poll the audience real time. So they polled the audience and said, how many of you think that all women should be induced labor at 39 weeks? And only about 30 to 40% answered yes. The rest answered no. By the end of their talk, it had completely flipped, and 72% agreed that based on the presentation that all pregnant women should be considered induced at 39 weeks. So it spread like wildfire. And the study, though, it has so many leaks, and I encourage people to go and look at, like, Lamaze did a great rundown of what was wrong with the study, like the things that were missing from the study. But in the facilities that they were looking at, it reduced the cesarean rate from 22% to 18%. So it was only a 3% reduction. But the other thing that's critical about that is they were doing the induction in a very specific way.
Yeah, it was very controlled.
Right.
Which cannot be duplicated on a mass scale at all.
That's right. And also, if you're a provider who has a 50 to 60% cesarean rate, that study doesn't apply to you. Mm. Right. But nobody's having that discussion.
Right.
So, because if your cesarean rate is already that high, there's a serious problem in the way that you're behaving, right?
Yeah. How the provider is practicing. Yeah.
Yeah. But also the other thing that any of these studies don't take into account is the physical experience of the pregnant person, mm-hmm. right? They don't take into account that a labor on average takes 2 to 3 days. Mm-hmm. And in many hospitals, they're preventing them from eating mm-hmm. and drinking. And they are, strapped with all these wires, right? Monitors, the IV, the thing. Now the baby is showing distress. So now we've got to put a pressure monitor inside your vagina. That was, the things that are happening. I mean, I remember having a client who she really didn't want to be induced, but she was feeling very pressured by her provider. And so she went through with it. And I just remember her standing there and she had all these wires. She had a pulse ox, an IV, two of the monitors, the monitor in between her legs because they had broke her water and monitored the baby. And she just looked at me and she goes, "What the fuck?"
Yeah.
And I was just like, "I'm so sorry."
Yeah. I don't think people realize it. It's almost like they should make you watch a video everything that could go into an induction. And then if you're like, cool, I'm good with that, then awesome. But right. I don't think that there's ever full informed consent around an induction.
Yeah. Well, but then if you try to, you're fear mongering, right? Like I get that a lot. You're fear mongering. It's like, and then you get the people who are like, my induction was amazing. Or I've had 4 inductions. They've been amazing. Like do some inductions go beautifully and perfectly and smooth?
Absolutely
they do, but there's 30 to 40% that don't.
Yeah,
that's a large number when you're talking about 3.9 million births in a year, when 30 to 40% of them don't go okay.
Yeah, no, those numbers are a deep call for alarm. What would you say to someone listening right now possibly pregnant and terrified. What would you say to them? I know, we're sorry, but these are conversations we need to be having. What would you say to them about what they could do to help reduce those odds of having all of these medical interventions?
There's so many ways now, right? I mean, I think getting an out of the hospital childbirth education is critical. Mm-hmm. And looking for good resources out there that are dependable and reliable. I mean, of course, I'm going to say hire a doula if you can. I get that most people don't find themselves with a lot of that extra money. But even coming to Birthify, right? Because Birthify is definitely less expensive than having a doula. But I think education and information is key to all of it.
Yeah.
And being able, and even then, even if you can't, go anytime your physician is making a suggestion, go look it up and say the risks and benefits to this.
Yeah.
Even if you just start there. Risks and benefits to induction, risks and benefits to a membrane sweep, mm-hmm. risks and benefits, whatever.
Yeah.
And you're going to be able to at least disseminate the information and decide if that's for you.
Yeah.
Are you plus size and pregnant or trying to conceive? Do you wonder where you can find cute plus size maternity clothes? Or when you'll start showing and how to embrace your pregnant body? What about having a healthy pregnancy and how to reduce your increased risk? Find the answers to these questions and so much more within the My Plus Size Pregnancy Guide and audiobook. From nutrition and physical activity to prenatal care expectations and the importance of hiring a size-friendly care provider, you'll not only learn information to help you make informed decisions throughout your pregnancy, but start to develop a new relationship with your body. Download this guide and start using it at any point in your pregnancy. Stop Googling and start feeling empowered today. Use code PLUSMOMMY to get 20% off the My Plus Size Pregnancy Guide and audiobook.
Where would you want things to go in another 10 years from now? Like, you've been at this for so long, and while we're moving up a little and we're having conversations we weren't having then and we're seeing some change, we're also going backwards in some ways. What is it? You want the cesarean rate to go down, but what do you think it's going to take for that to actually happen?
I mean, I think it's a couple of big things that have to happen. First of all, the consumer has to push for change.
Yeah.
We know that 100%. Things do not change in a hospital environment unless the consumer is pushing it and multiple consumers push it. So
yeah. And there's studies to back that up. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what we know. But I think one of the things I would love to see is retraining and hospitals getting certified in informed consent.
Yeah.
And what that really means, and really having a mind shift on who's the boss mm-hmm. in the situation. The patient is always the boss, not the doctor, not the nurse, not the hospital. The patient is always the boss. I'd love to see that shift in mentality. I'd love to see more midwives. And in fact, you know, I think it would be brilliant if we could do what Europe does, and 70% of our patients are seen by midwives instead of surgeons, because I know that would make a big difference. We're going to have a massive shortage in physicians very, very quickly. We're already seeing it. And that's a problem. And I think midwifery is a big answer to that question. And let's be clear about why I say that, because midwives and doctors are trained very differently. Mm-hmm. Midwives are trained in normal physiological birth, and physicians are trained in pathological birth. That means that a doctor is looking for a problem, and they're taught how to fix problems and avoid problems, right? There's some benefit to that, but oftentimes, you know, I've talked to many physicians, and I would say the thing that they say all the time is the hardest thing as a surgeon is to sit on their hands and do nothing and wait. And many don't do that, or it's just not their style, right? So you wind up, you know, I mean, the fact that this is one of the only specialties and that we have a specialist, right? Or the only thing in medicine that we have a specialist doing the day-to-day stuff. Mm-hmm. When the reality is this, those specialists should be handling the special circumstances.
Yeah, do we need, high risk pregnancies.
Surgeons, 100%. Do we need them to be on call at hospitals when those when a birth goes sideways and somebody needs help? 100%.
Yeah.
But we know that midwifery care over and over and over again in every study has shown better outcomes. And that's where we need to shift to. And I love my, I don't know, do you know Kitty Ernst?
No.
Oh my God. She's just, she's a god. She passed away actually last year, but she was my mentor. She was the founder, one of the founders of Frontier Nursing University.
Yeah.
And was a midwife for, you know, ran one of the first birth centers in the East Coast. Like she's that lady. She died in her 90s. And she was just an incredible, but she said to me, she would call me and rant on a regular basis and about the healthcare system, because she really believed in me and believed in my ability to make a difference, you know? And so she said to me, you know, one of the best answers that we could have is we should be training all nurses right now to be midwives.
Wow.
And that, I mean, that would eliminate the lack of care very quickly because nurses are already halfway there.
Yeah.
Right? These RNs that are labor and delivery nurses, obviously. And they have so much experience typically.
Oh, yeah. They know it all. Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, they know so much. And if you just took then some funding, which, you know, I'm working on, you mentioned legislation, the Midwives for Moms Act is about funding education for midwives. And wouldn't it be incredible if, you know, we could just train all the nurses to be midwives?
That would be amazing. Just promise me with all this work and push that we also include the conversation about removing BMI restrictions, because like we see in Europe and other areas, while they have lower cesarean birth rates, they still classify everyone with a higher BMI as a high risk. And then they go down a different path where I've said, and I remember I made this meme when memes were just like beginning to be a thing, is like care provider bias against people of size plays a role in the astronomical cesarean birth rate. I mean, we see such high, high numbers, especially for people in larger bodies. And yet we try to create these systems, but we exclude people who have a higher BMI, even if they are overall healthy and having a low risk pregnancy. So I had to jump on my soapbox real quick, Dawn.
I'm a, you know, I'm a plus size woman. So I feel that. And I'll tell you that I had a physician discourage me about getting pregnant. He was my regular doctor. And I was so excited because we had decided that we were going to have more kids, my husband and I. And I was so excited about it. And I was talking to him about it. And I was like, I'm so excited. I think, you know, we've decided we're going to have more kids and blah, blah. And he said, you need to lose a lot of weight before you get pregnant because you will absolutely have gestational diabetes. I was so floored and he just took all the wind out of my sails. Right. I was just sharing this exciting news. And well, I'll tell you, I had 4 pregnancies, never had gestational diabetes. I gained 50 pounds. And my blood pressure was amazing. My blood work was always amazing.
We can be healthy at any size, and we need to meet people where they're at and treat them with support and compassion, because them saying that to you plants that seed of, oh, I am going to, there's something wrong with me. And then you have all this stress and, you know, all this stuff that leads to like fulfilling a prophecy. It's so wrong how people of size are treated. And when we look statistically, we're looking at about 60% of people who can become pregnant in the United States are classified as overweight and obese. So I really wish that this was a part of the conversation of reducing the cesarean birth rate by not excluding people from access to the midwifery model of care and birth center and out of hospital birth, but including and creating more safeguards and more, you know, just support. And I saw that with the National Institutes of Health, with the Pregnancy for Every Body initiative that I worked with them on, but that launched in November of 2019. And then what, a month later, when I'm like, yeah, we'll promote and all this stuff. There's this thing called COVID happening and we've all shifted.
Yeah. I mean,
which of course we should have, but it was just like, finally a national organization isn't just saying, obesity crisis and pregnancy. They're saying, how can we support people with compassion and dignity and provide evidence-based information in a way that's not fear-mongering?
Well, and individualized care.
Right.
Right. This is such, and that's what I'm saying about even Birthify, why that's happening is because that's the problem is there's this, you know, even for people who do develop diabetes in pregnancy, gestational diabetes, they just use this blanket like, right. Oh, well, we got to do an induction at 38 weeks or 39 weeks. Like there's no, that, like, that's just the way it is. And it's like, no, that's not true. That's not what the research says. The research says you could, but you can avoid it. Also, you can wait if these certain things are not happening. Mm-hmm. But most pregnant folks have no idea what that is, or they never even have their doctors and like, okay, so here's the risks and benefits to staying pregnant and waiting for labor to start on its own. If we start seeing signs of these things, then we might need to intervene. Like that's a discussion that should be happening instead of, all right, so you've got gestational diabetes. We're definitely going to induce you at 39 weeks, period.
Yeah. But and then, so many parents don't know they have the options to be like, that doesn't sound right to me. I'm going to go get a second opinion or I'm firing you. And I'm like, and also just the emotional and financial baggage to even be able to fire a care provider and hire someone new.
Yes. Oh my gosh. That's like a, well, I mean, I think people don't even realize that it's possible.
Yeah.
You know, and it, and I always say it's possible. Is it difficult sometimes? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
It will take determination and tenacity. Yep.
Yeah.
You know, like, yep, it sure does, but it's entirely possible.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
A lot of people don't know that.
So why don't we talk about Born Free, the documentary? I watched it. It's incredible. I watched it on Google Play, but I know it's trying to get on Amazon Prime and has a fair amount of
my understanding. Oh, good. It's there now on Amazon Prime and it's on Apple TV and what was the other one? Google Play.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, why don't you tell us briefly a little synopsis about it? And then you said something really powerful. I mean, you said a lot of great things, but there's two things that really stood out to me that I wanted to talk about briefly.
Okay, great. Well, it's a pretty well-rounded film.
It is.
About the maternal health system. Like it covers a lot of things, the maternal mortality rate, the overuse of interventions, just the entire system itself and the lack of information and how women, you know, walk into this process with little to no information.
Yeah.
And I interviewed with her, with Paula, I guess 4 years ago.
Wow.
Funny enough, it was exactly 4 years ago to that. It came up in my memories from Facebook of us filming. I had taken pictures and stuff filming and the next day it released. So it was to the date and I was her first interview. Aww. So she was introduced to me by one of my board members for Improving Birth. And so COVID really, you know, made it take a lot longer, obviously, but, it's been just an incredible process for her, I think. And, you know, I have a lot of hopes for it. I don't know if it's as palatable for the consumer as The Business of Being Born was.
Yeah. It's different.
It is. It's totally different. And I mean, of course it's different. It should be different.
Yes, yes.
But I think I would say that if you're pregnant, I'm not sure it's something that I would encourage people to watch because I think it's a little bit scary, you know?
Yeah. But if you've given birth and whether it was a positive, negative, or somewhere in the middle experience, and you want to think about birth more and you want to talk about birth more and you want to be a part of this conversation for change, I think it's an easy thing to watch and be like, oh, that's what's going on.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that it could, my hope is that it's actually a wake up call for the system.
Yeah.
I hope that, you know, I hope that every hospital administrator in the nation watches that film.
Yeah.
That's my hope for it. Yeah. Is that's, I think that's where it has more of a place is as a change agent.
Yeah. And you know, just an example of how it's really intense is that, you know, we talk about the story of Kimberly, who was given an episiotomy without consent, actually being told, saying no. And it was captured on video. But you talk about how when you were trying to raise awareness and, you know, by going through the court system so it would raise awareness and financially impact Because if we show that there was a financial impact, oh, people pay attention to this and doctors can lose their licenses for, you know, not listening to someone say, no, don't do something to my body without my consent. But you said you went to 80 different lawyers before anyone would take the case.
We did, even with video evidence of the assault.
Yeah. And the video evidence is played during the documentary and it is just horrific.
Horrific. Mm. And it's such a small snippet of actually what happened. Right. So, you know, if anybody wants to watch it and they can handle it, it's on YouTube. They can just do forced episiotomy. Yeah. It should come up. It's had over a million views.
Yeah. I've seen the whole thing. It is hard to stomach.
It's hard to stomach. I still can't. Even watching it in the film made me cry.
Yeah.
As soon as because I'm like, I'm traumatized by watching it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I can't even imagine poor Kimberly.
I know. And, and lifelong physical ramifications that she deals with to this day.
Yeah, for sure.
But 80.
Yeah, it was a big project for Improving Birth. And we learned a heck of a lot. I talk about this a lot because we used to get families all the time that would come to us and say, we want to sue our doctor for assault. And by the way, we were the very first, Kimberly's case was the very first assault case against an obstetrician in the state of California.
Wow.
That should tell you something. Lots of malpractice lawsuits, but this was not malpractice. No. This was an assault. This was an informed consent violation and not a malpractice. And that was our biggest issue, was the lawyers all just came back and said, well, if they responded at all, most of them just didn't even respond. But many of them just like, I mean, we actually got laughed at a couple times. Laughed at, literally, like, your guys are dumb. Like, can't believe you're even doing this. There's no money. You're not going to get any money from him. And by the way, he's a doctor. He gets to do whatever he wants. That was the mentality we were.
That makes me physically ill to hear. Like, oh, you have no rights over your body. They're doctors. They can do whatever they want to you.
That's right. And it was a doctor knows best. Like, you need to trust the medical professional. I mean, these were this is what we were getting from the lawyers, even who video. Maybe. I mean, who knows if they actually watched the video, but they basically were like, well, unless mom and baby are severely damaged, you're not going to get any money. And of course, she was just like, it's not about the money.
No, it's about, you know, holding this happened to me. This is wrong.
Right.
We need to hold someone accountable. And the whole system needs to be held accountable for what's
happening.
That's
right. It was never about the money.
No, of course not.
She never got a lot. She did finally settle, but for menial amount. And of course, the lawyer that did take her case took 40% of it. You know, it was never about the money.
No.
But, so that's fine.
But she still lives in pain. I mean,
that's right. That's right. Every
she
day.
Does
and my,
live
and my
in
personal
pain.
opinion is that she should have got a heck of a lot more.
Yes.
But that was, you know, I mean, he relinquished his license.
Good.
But there was an investigation going on with the medical board. But, you know, our article in Yahoo that went viral and her video 6 months after she'd already filed the case in the medical board was finally what made them respond to her. She hadn't heard anything in 6 months from the medical board. And so they finally, the media attention is what drew them to finally do an investigation. And as soon as they started the investigation and we served him papers, he relinquished his license within a couple weeks, which halted the investigation 100%. So he apparently was already planning to retire. Mm. We just forced him to retire a few months early. And so, but the unfortunate part of that is there, you know, the medical board's procedure in that is then if he relinquishes his license, there's nothing more. We're done. So they never did an investigation or very little of one, and it never had any outcomes. She never got any notification about what was going to happen or what happened, you know. And even then, we only found out through the court system, through the court case, that he had relinquished his license. Nobody notified her or nothing. So, again, just another example of broken systems.
But also an example of something that you were a part of. I mean, a decade ago, we didn't even hear of the words birth rape. We weren't talking about obstetrical violence. And so thank you for your work to help make these really uncomfortable and hard conversations, necessary conversations to be having to enact change. And for anyone listening, if your body is touched or something happens to you without consent, that was wrong. And I wish you didn't have to fight so hard to get that validation that Kimberly needed and wanted. But we need to keep having it and fighting for it so our children aren't fighting for it when they're going through their pregnancies and births.
So what I love is that a lot of people don't know this, but Kimberly is now, I love her so much. She is now working as an advocate for a consumer watchdog group.
Yes.
And she has been testifying every month at the California Medical Board.
What a badass.
She goes in every month through the consumer group. The consumer group gives her all the things that she can say, which is super helpful. But she has become really passionate. And just recently, so there's a whistleblower about the California Medical Board. Have you heard about this?
No.
There's an article that just came out a few days ago about this whistleblower. So this person was invited to participate in the medical board review. So he's on the board of the medical board. And he was on a previous medical board through, I think, orthopedics or something, a different branch. So he had lots of experience with being on a medical board. He came to the medical board and apparently was appalled at how it was being managed. And he brought it to their attention. And he was like, listen, this is a problem. You are not protecting the customer. You are protecting the doctors. And this is unacceptable. And if you don't change it, I'm going to blow the whistle. And they didn't change it. So he became a whistleblower. And they just, and there was a cap on recovery for situations like this, for labor and delivery. There was a cap of only 250,000. And they just increased the cap because of all the work that Kimberly has been doing with this consumer group.
Oh, so, gosh, that's incredible.
Again, all of this terrible stuff happened to her and she's just turning
she's
it into,
turning into something positive.
I love it. I'm so
The other thing that stood out that you said, I wanted to be like, let's end this on a positive, but it's kind of like positive, but also frustrating, is that you said something really powerful. You said doulas are a Band-Aid on a broken system. And the minute you said that, I was like, oh, she's so right. So again, reiterating the importance whenever possible to have the support of a doula or Birthify, to have, you know, virtual. And I know there's other virtual doula programs, but having that doula support can make such an impact right now when we're still so fighting for change within a system. So it's one thing that does make a big difference. And I know it's a, you know, you're a doula. It's a passion of yours too, and a passion of mine too. I really love doulas, and my life was changed by a doula support as well.
Yeah. Well, I think doulas are a critical piece in all of this. But I also would like, if we want to end it on some hope.
Yeah, let's do that.
My friend Amber Price is the first midwife. I don't know her name, but you should. You should have her on your show for sure. She's the first midwife to reach CEO position in a hospital.
Wow.
And yeah, she has moved up the ranks. She was recently in Nashville as the COO of a women's hospital there. And she has gone into, I think, 3 or 4 facilities now into hospitals and totally changed everything.
Wow.
And she's been able to successfully reduce the hospital C-section rate, their induction rate, improved outcomes for both moms and babies. Their breastfeeding rates have skyrocketed. So every time she goes into a facility, she's making massive change. Mm. And what's even better for the hospital is their bottom line is improving.
Right, right. There is incentive monetarily for them to do better.
Right. Well, because a lot of times they think, well, you can't, if you're not doing all these interventions, that's going to really impact the bottom line. But what's happening is they're getting a better reputation. Mm-hmm. And so more families are coming there, which increases their bottom line. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she also really believes in water birth and, you know, so many things. And so, you know, she's one person. But what I love to understand, and I think that she would be great to have a conversation of what this means at the minuscule level of like, how is she making that the physicians change mm-hmm. their behavior? How is she helping nurses change their behavior? And it's entirely possible. And I think that if we can bottle up what she's doing we can help other facilities. And that's my goal.
Our
Bottle Up, which is doing.
Yes.
And really start getting into these hospitals and teaching them how to be different.
And I think she's one of many. I think of like Dr. Neal Shah, who we've had on the show, and like so many other, especially younger physicians who are like, this needs to change. The racism, sexism, like all the, you know, how LGBTQ plus people are treated in maternity care, like this needs to have a radical shift, and it should have happened decades ago. So there's a lot of hope, but we also have to unpack the journey to get to a place of even having hope or even having these conversations that you helped to ignite.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm pretty sure it's what I'll be doing for the rest of my life until I take my last breath. I'm going to be Kitty when I'm 90, calling some young whippersnapper who's now taking on the mission, and I'm going to rant to her, I'm sure.
I love that.
And encourage her, you know.
My goal has always been to be put out of business and to not have a need for plus size birth. And we just treat people of size like we treat anyone during pregnancy with respect and dignity and provide individualized health care.
I would love to be put out of business.
Yeah. Well, Dawn, tell us a little bit more about Birthify before we end, where people can find you, how they can connect, and all that you offer, because you are amazing. And I even so enjoy this conversation. Thank you.
Well, we've got a Birthify channel on TikTok where I, you know, do all the things. So you're welcome. I'm actually doing okay over there.
I've got about 25,000
followers.
Heck yeah.
In just a couple months. So I'm feeling good about that. I'd love for people to come and interact with me over there and, you know, share the videos, because I think that's how people get more information out to them. Right. So, but obviously birthify.net, that's our website. We offer free consultations, so you can come in and schedule. It's right there. The link to schedule a call is there, and it's free. We charge a weekly rate, so you can cancel anytime. We do bill it monthly, but again, cancel anytime, and you can stay with us as long as you'd like. You know
That's
what I
incredible.
Mean?
Like, yeah.
And you get assigned a single person. So so you have the same person through the pregnancy and all the way through your postpartum period. And so the goal is that you build a trusting relationship with someone that you can just chat with. And even if you're just having a hard time for postpartum depression, you've got somebody to talk to, you know.
Do they also offer virtual support for labor and delivery, or is it more the educational before?
Yeah, it's an additional cost to do labor support. So we've done it multiple times.
Yeah.
Unintentionally, there's sometimes the relationship was built so wonderfully that the doula calls in early labor. I mean, the client calls in early labor, and then suddenly, you know, 5 hours pass and we've been on the phone. You know, like that just is, it's happened. So, you know, it's absolutely possible.
But I could see that being really beneficial for people that don't necessarily want another person in their birthing space, but they want that virtual support. And whether it be, you know, on video or just audio and text, like to still have that lifeline of someone providing evidence-based information that's not medical. They're not giving you medical advice, but they're helping you and easing your concerns and fears. Like,
I can tell you a story actually of, you know, in the early days, I took on a lot of the first clients, right? Myself, right? That's what you do when you're doing a startup. And I had one client that all kinds of crazy stuff was happening. She was supposed to be at home birth, but the midwives were at another birth at their birth center. And so they asked her to come there instead, which wasn't her plan. Right. She was showing signs of preeclampsia. And when she got there, she was already 8 centimeters. I had literally talked her through the whole labor on the phone. And we never did video chat, but she was like, I could tell that her labor was getting really active.
Yeah, you can hear it. A doula can hear when you're about to go through transition.
And she was just like, I think they're going to be done, because they said, if we finish before, you know, we'll come, but you might need to come here, you know, kind of thing. And she was holding out, and I was like, honey, I think you probably need to go. You need to, and by the way, the birth center was like 45 minutes away, And so I was like, I think you need to go. And then I'm thinking like, okay, she's a first timer. I don't want to send her too early. I don't want to cause her this stress but I'm not there. And so I actually, you know, people can look up the purple line in the butt crack.
Yeah.
Right. Or the red line in the butt crack indicates the dilation. Mm-hmm. And so I had her husband, I'm like, had her husband take a picture of her behind, of her bottom. And I said, can you please, you know, this is what we're looking for. Take a picture of it and send it to me. And he sent it to me and it was almost to the top. And I was like, she needs to get in the car right now. And she got to the birth center and she was 8 centimeters. Her blood pressure was off the charts. Mm. And the midwife actually jumped on the phone with me and she was just like, I think she's going to have the baby before I can get her to the hospital, but this is not good, right? Yeah. Like she's, her blood pressure's off the charts. And I said, you know, like do what you got to do. I understand. She's like, I think I'm just going to have her deliver the baby, but then we need to send her immediately to the hospital.
Yeah.
So within 15 minutes of delivering, they called an ambulance and the ambulance was waiting there.
Wow.
And I was on the phone with her in the ambulance to the hospital. I stayed on the phone with her for 2 more hours at the hospital, you know, and her husband wasn't able to go because he had to stay behind with the baby. Mm. And so she's by herself without her baby.
Alone.
She only got to hold the baby for 15 minutes. Mm. And then she was off again. But I mean, I just talked her through everything.
Yeah.
And you know, it was literally the lifeline. It was literally her lifeline. Ugh. And that's how she described it.
That's amazing.
She's like, I can't even imagine doing that without you.
Yeah.
You know, and that wasn't the plan. It just kind of happened. So.
Wow. Anyways, well, that's
it's entirely possible to have virtual support.
Yes, it is. Wow. That's incredible. Well, I hope everyone will check out your resources. I deeply, deeply appreciate all the work you have done for so, so many years. And I can't wait for the next decade that we will be colleagues in this work of trying to improve maternal health care for all. So thank you, Dawn, so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, friends. Until next time. Bye.
See ya.